This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. Neil Conan is away. Do you know how much your home is worth? Seems like nobody does. Home values have declined for the seventh straight quarter, and many have been forced to sell their houses for less than they paid. Even if you're not looking to sell, the value of your home could put a dent in your financial future. And it seems like the only thing that's sure is that nobody knows where the bottom of the real estate market is. This economy is challenging conventional wisdom about the benefits of home ownership. Today, we'll talk to Business Week's Atlanta Bureau Chief Dean Faust. He'll give us a sense of housing values across the country, and to economist Robert Schiller about what happens next. We also want to hear from you. What's happening to the value of your home? How's it affecting your life? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255, 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website, npr.org. Go there, click on the Talk of the Nation. Later this hour, Roger Moore on his 007 adventures. But first, the value of your home, and we begin with Dean Faust of Business Week. His most recent op-ed is titled, Modifying Mortgages is Just a Band-Aid. He joins us from member station WABE in Atlanta, Georgia. Welcome, Dean Faust.
Oh, good afternoon.
So could you give us a sense of home values across the country? What places are worst hit? Which areas are doing all right?
Interestingly, year over year, if you look at the latest data, Case-Shiller Home Price Index and data, only two areas in the country have experienced more than a 1% year-over-year appreciation in the average home value of a home that was sold, upstate New York and many parts of North Carolina.
Hmm.
Everywhere else is down.
Gosh.
So, and if you look at areas, I think year-over-year nationwide, home values are down about 16 to 17%.
And in your
on average nationwide, but it's really this is a case where not every area is equal. All real estate is local, as they say, and you're looking at areas in Southern California, South Florida that are down a good 25-30%.
And in your op-ed, you said that home prices nationwide still need to drop another 15 to 20%.
On average, that's the number. And again, all real estate is local, as the old saying goes. Depends where you live. I live in a suburb just north of downtown Atlanta, and I use one of these handy calculators that I came across on the internet, and by the calculations, which I can explain, it said that my neighborhood was probably our zip code was overvalued by about 10%, but use those same calculations, and you'll see that in many areas of San Diego, Los Angeles, Southern California, South Florida, homes are still as much as 30 to 50% overvalued. They would have to fall by that much.
Now, you mentioned the Case-Shiller Home Price Index. Joining us now is Robert Schiller. He's his co-founder and chief economist of macro markets, and he's the co-developer of the Case-Shiller Home Price Indices. Robert Schiller joins us now from member station WGBH in Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome, sir.
Hi, Andrea.
Now, you are the man who wrote about irrational exuberance in the housing market. You were seen to be kind of a downer at the time, but you've proved to be right time and again. So do you think at this point that we've hit the bottom, or do you think, as Dean Faust is saying, that there's another 15 to 20% to go?
Well, as a producer of the Case-Shiller, S&P Case-Shiller indices, I'm not going to forecast quantitatively, but I can point out that there is a futures market at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, and it is predicting for the typical city that's traded, which are big cities, about a 15% decline, bottoming out in around 2 years from now.
How do they know that? I mean, when it seems no one knows anything about how much home values are.
Well, that is a market price, although mm-hmm. I have to say it's not a very thick market, and so we shouldn't take it as God's truth. And markets can certainly be wrong, and so I don't mean to make too much of it. The fundamental thing is that nobody really knows where it's going to go. If it goes down another 15-20%, that would bring it down about 50% in real terms from the peak in some of the most volatile markets. That means that we would have erased all of the gains in the housing bubble. And that's quite a dramatic drop if that happens. But we don't know what's going to happen. It's possible that the market will recover soon, and it's also possible that it will overshoot. We're really in uncharted territory. This country and the world is going through the biggest economic crisis since the Great Depression, and all bets are off on just what's going to happen.
So I guess I have a question to pose to both of you then. What can you even say that gives us some concrete knowledge about the asset, the biggest asset that most people own if they own a home, what it's worth and therefore their financial position is? I mean, is it just hands in the air? Who knows? Let me go to you, Dean Faust.
It's a little bit hands in the air, who knows. But I think this experience, this crisis is going to take us back to the way life was before the housing bubble that we've gone through over the past 20 years, which was that housing was the place that you lived. It was the place where you raised your family and you taught your kid how to throw a baseball in the backyard and they you built a sandbox and such. You raised your family. You paid it down over 30 years, and you had something worth of value, and not just this giant. Homes became trading commodities, or like a bubble stock. And I think we're going to go back to that area where you may see 3% appreciation every year, something along the lines of inflation. You get a modest return.
What do you think, Mr. Schiller?
Well, we have been through a speculative bubble, and that caused a rapid an unprecedented increase in the home values in this country because, I think, of investor enthusiasm. It was a get-rich-quick scheme. Ultimately, the value of homes should be something in line with construction cost without too big a land component. And that suggests that the kind of home prices that we've had for the last 50 years are kind of about right, and we've gone way above that. Fortunately, the correction has moved along quite far, and so we've entered a kind of gray area where it's not so clear where we're going from here.
Okay, gentlemen, let's listen to some of our callers now. Let's go to Will in Oak Park, Illinois. Tell us about your house.
My house I bought about 15 years ago for the average price in Oak Park. And of course, through the bubble, it went through the roof in our area. I mean, it was I paid 175. We paid 175, and at the peak of the bubble, it was appraised at almost 600,000, which I thought was ridiculous. I've never thought of houses as a commodity to buy and sell. It's not really. It's something you buy to stay in, and if you can make some money off it, when you're done, that's fine. That's the way it should be.
Could I interject?
Yes, please.
I note that you're from Oak Park, Illinois. That is the first city in the world to issue home equity insurance.
Yeah.
And so I think that program, as far as I know, in Oak Park is no longer there. But if you had, you could have insured against those risks.
The insurance, I believe, was part of when we went to equal housing in 1968 to insure the values against real estate speculators who were coming in and blockbusting. And it wasn't really a hedge against the bubble.
That's interesting. We'll have to look into that. But what about the bigger question? It sounds a lot like you, Will, are getting at what Dean Faust was saying, that there was a change in psyche in the American idea of what a home was. It went from being a place you live to a place where you invested your money. Dean Faust?
That's how our grandparents thought. That's how our parents' generation thought. This is a relatively new phenomenon. And again, I think it's where we'll go when we get through this crisis, but that could be sometime down the road. I think that there will be a generation of home buyers, the kids who are in college now and will be buying their first home in 5 or 10 or 15, whenever, down the road, who will look back and wonder why the previous generation thought a house was something you speculated in, that it was your biggest investment. I don't think they'll look at it that way. But where we are now and when we get to that point sometime out in the future, I do still think there's going to be a lot of pain. the indicators that I talked about, they were based off of an old-fashioned rule of thumb that bankers use for generations or decades, that a borrower shouldn't really realistically spend more than 28% of their gross income on their mortgage payment and insurance every month. And at the height of the bubble, there were lenders that were going 50% or higher. And what we've done is now homes, that $600,000 home, you have priced out so many, the next generation of buyers. There are so few people, far fewer, that could afford that house than when it was 170. And so prices have got to come back down in line with incomes. And I think that in some of these bubble markets, that's just going to be, whether it happens fast or slow, they got to come back down in line with incomes.
Robert Schiller, let me put this email to you. This is from Heidi in Tempe, Arizona. She says, we got a line of credit in April. The bank devalued our home last month, hence lowered our line of credit. We just had an appraisal done showing our home is valued above the value it was in April. Our personal neighborhood is holding steady, which can't be said for the Phoenix metro area. I mean, this part of what makes this so confusing, Robert Schiller, is that things seem to be all over the place.
Well, they're all over the place, although lately they've been down a lot more. Unfortunately, it's very hard to appraise a house. And I don't envy people who have to do that as a job in a market like this. If you look at comparable sales, you better get relatively recent ones,
yeah,
because things have been changing so fast. So I'm not surprised that your appraisal looked anomalous. That's part of the difficulties of the market right now.
I want to get to more of our callers here in just after the break. Please call us at 800-989-8255. We'd like to hear about the value of your home, what's happened to it, and how it's affecting your life, your financial situation, and so on. So we're talking about what's happening to the value of your home and people across the country. Tell us your story, 800-989-8255, or you can drop us an email. The address is talk@npr.org. I'm Andrea Seabrook. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. It's not all bad news for home prices. You out there in New York and parts of the Carolinas, the value of your house may have gone up in the past year. That's according to the Case-Shiller Home Price Indices. Unfortunately for the rest of us, though, you're in a tiny minority. Today, we're talking about the value of your home, what's happening, and how's it affecting your life. 800-989-8255. You can also reach us by email, talk@npr.org. Let me remind you that our listeners this hour are Dean Faust. He's the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week magazine, and Robert Schiller, the co-founder and chief economist of Macro Markets. He's also author of the book, The Subprime Solution: How Today's Global Financial Crisis Happened and What to Do About It. First, let's go to our listeners. This is Moira in Northport, Florida. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I live in Northport, Florida, which is in the county of Sarasota. I'm a new homeowner. I bought a home for $250,000. The bank reassessed it for $100,000 less than its value, and then came along and took away my $50,000 home equity line of credit because the value dropped out of my home. I never even touched the line of credit. I do have a good FICO score and good credit, but I've lost the value in my home. There's no way I can sell it and get the money back. I mean, what is the government going to do for homeowners that are in good standing but are basically in the same boat as everybody else?
Dean Faust?
The government, for those who are able to pay their mortgage, there's not much that the government, I'm afraid, is going to do. The government did this week announce a program for homeowners who have, or at least 90 days late on their mortgage, who are proving that they are unable to pay the terms, meet the terms of the mortgage that they took out in the past several years, where they are going to modify the terms of the loan to try and bring the interest rate down. It can be a combination of several factors. Bring the interest rate down. They can stretch out the term of the loan, rewrite the loan. So instead of having 20 years left, you stretch it to 30, or if it's 28, you go to 40. so you can lower the monthly payment down to something closer that you can afford. Unfortunately for the caller, that only applies to folks who have already missed three payments or more. There are some WAGs who were joking that maybe the way to help yourself is to just simply quit paying your mortgage.
Yes,
so you can qualify. I'm not sure the government is aware of that risk, and I think they're already on to that.
As I understand it, Robert Shiller, one of the pitfalls of coming up with an idea for helping actual people with their actual mortgages is that if you start offering help, then a whole lot more people suddenly, quote, won't be able to pay their mortgage.
Well, this is a great topic. I talk at some length about this in my book, Subprime Solution. It's really unfair that we're bailing out people who don't pay, who are irresponsible. But we're in a terribly messy situation. And I think the best thing to do now is to try to avoid getting in that situation again. So I think the government has to set up standards, or industry has to set up standards for mortgages that are more flexible. And I'd like to see Moira's home equity line of credit get some of the benefits that mortgages had. And these things could all be done it's kind of complicated about structuring mortgages. I talked particularly about creating a continuous workout mortgage that would grant some aspects of workouts to everyone without their even asking. It just isn't right that it should only be a few people who kind of randomly get these helps. It should really be something that's structured and planned for and is offered to everyone so that there's no game playing and no dishonesty involved in trying to get the break.
Boy, offering it to everyone, though, sure sounds expensive.
I'm talking about a revolution in the way we do mortgages. It would have to be priced into the cost of the mortgage.
Hmm. Let's go to Eric in Nevada City, California. Hi, Eric.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. Go ahead with your comment.
Hi, I'm in the green building industry here in California, and I'm commenting on your host or your guest there say about the cost of construction being in line with the cost of houses. What I've noticed here is that with the recent raises in construction taxes in the last 7 years, you cannot build for what houses are selling for in much of California at this point.
Hmm. So home prices are even lower than the. Let me ask you, Eric, are you still there? Eric was saying that home prices are even lower than the cost of construction in some places. Dean Faust, do you know anything about this?
That is possible, and that is happening in a few pockets around the country. Based on a lot of factors, there may be local regulations that that have the effect of raising the cost of what it takes to build a house. Look, in all this gloom and doom, there are going to be pockets where there are absolute bargains, particularly if you are buying a foreclosed home. I don't want to think about the idea that you profit from someone else's misery, but banks really aren't set up to try to play the role of real estate agent or broker. They don't want a house. They don't want to have to take a house back. A year ago, banks were losing about 25% if they had to take back a home through foreclosure and then sell it, they were usually taking about a 25% loss on what they originally loaned out. Now they're saying they're taking about a 46% loss. And I do think that, again, banks don't want to be real estate agents. They want to be brokers. If you follow the foreclosures, you can probably get a good bargain.
So it's safe to say with those foreclosures and with a lot of houses on the market, that it's pretty much a buyer's market right now. If you're sitting around, if you're sitting on a couple $100,000, then you're in a good place. What happens? When does it shift? I mean, eventually that demand will get soaked up. How long, Robert Shiller?
Well, I think we have to put this whole housing situation in a broader context. We have seen not just home prices fall. We've seen stock market prices fall. The stock market is down in real terms 55% from its recent peak in the summer of 2007. We've seen oil prices fall. We've seen this happening around the world. It's a worldwide economic crisis. And So the U.S. is just part of this. And one thing that someone has to think about in making any financial decision now is what is going to happen to all of these things. What's going to happen to my other investments? What's going to happen to my job? And how is this housing market going to recover unless the economy recovers? And we're thinking of the world economy. It's a very big and dangerous picture. And the real cause of it at this point is the fears that are widespread around the world about when this whole world economy is going to bottom out.
Yeah, remember a year ago in the summer of 2007, the big story all over the news was gas prices and how it was affecting people's pocketbooks. And there was just so much talk about it. And someone said to me recently, hey, you know, my IRA has lost $100,000, but I'm paying $15 less for gas. You know, it's sort of the gas prices have come down, but who cares at this point?
Well, there's a silver lining in every cloud. But people are talking about the Great Depression now. You didn't bring that up, and maybe I shouldn't. Maybe that's an alarming word. But I'm not making it up. People are worrying about that. And that is what is itself. Roosevelt said the only thing to fear is fear itself. And unfortunately, we're in that cycle now.
That fear cycle.
Can I throw in a question here?
Yes,
and
please.
Ask Bob, Bob, are we headed into a Great Depression?
Well, I'm optimistic that it won't. I think there are parallels to what happened then. We are in a crisis of confidence, but I don't think it will be so bad. Fortunately, we do have a government that already, under President Bush, has taken a number of steps, I think inadequate, but they've helped. And we have a new president who is committed. One good luck we have, 1929, when that crash happened, they had to wait 3.5 years for a new president and a new administration to try something different. We've got that coming up in January. So I'm feeling guardedly optimistic that we will do the kinds of things that will make this into a recession, but nothing terrible.
Let's go to Catherine in Cincinnati, Ohio. Hi, tell us your story, Catherine.
Hi, I'm going through one of the longest divorces in human history. The economic downturn devalued our business. Now it's devalued our home. So it's affecting the equalization as we bicker back and forth trying to do a dissolution between my ex-husband or soon-to-be ex-husband and I. And on top of it, I got laid off August 1st. So I'm really in the middle of something kind of funky. And having my house worth basically what I paid for 8 years ago. It's not that much less, but we put 30 or 40 grand in it just in sweat equity and remodeling. So it is kind of affecting me kind of across the board.
Thanks very much for telling us about that, Catherine. Let's go to Dave in Independence, Missouri. Hi, Dave. Tell us tell us your story.
Well, we were just talking to the other gal. We had our house we bought 5 years ago for only $121,000. Neighbors of ours sold their houses in the $160,000 range. But now that there have been so many foreclosures, neighbors' houses are selling $56,000, $57,000, $58,000 because that's all the banks want for them. That's what they want us to sell our house for when we're nearing foreclosure now. The other thing that we run into are letters that we get. These letters are telling us that they will go to bat for us with our loan company, get permanent rate reduction, drop our interest rate, our payments, so they're able to help us keep our home. But those people are charging upwards of $2,000, $2,500 for them to go to bat for you. And when we're already behind, you know, it doesn't make any sense why the banks aren't just doing that automatically.
Thanks very much for speaking with us, Dave. Let me turn to you, Dean Faust. What are people supposed to do? And clearly we have calls and emails coming in from across the country. How do you tell people to deal with problems like these?
Actually, I'm glad the caller mentioned that because the letter that he received, obviously I haven't seen the letter, but I'm willing to bet that that's a scam. All you have to do is go to Google and type in mortgage modification. You can see signs, you know, the little kind that sit on the stick by the side of the road in some areas. A lot of scamsters out there. All they're going to do is take your money. They're really not going to be able to do much more for you, if anything, than you can do for yourself with your mortgage company. They're just going to take $2,000 to $3,000 in fees, and you'll be lucky. At best, they can't do anything that you can't, and at worst, they'll, you know, there are cases we I know of where people hire these. They think that they're negotiating with their lender. They're not, and in the process, they're being foreclosed on. Back to the question. Yeah, I think you should, you know, if you really are in trouble, you can either find a lawyer to help, you know, maybe an accountant, or, you know, check with your local government for the names and numbers of nonprofit organizations that this is what they do. They help people who have fallen behind, but ignore the letters and ignore the websites and the little signs on the side of the road.
And the banks themselves, some banks have already started to work with people on their mortgages, but it's very patchy. Yes?
They have. There are some individual banks, Bank of America, Citi, J.P. Morgan Chase, have all announced loan modification programs, and that's in addition to what the government is going to do through Fannie and Freddie. One thing they're not doing, I talked about how they're willing to stretch out the payments. They may be willing to lower the interest rate, or they may be willing to defer some of the interest. One thing they're not willing to do is to lower the principal. The banks are just not going to take that step. So any hope you may have that they'll take your $300,000 mortgage and shave it to $220,000 is just not going to happen. That they may be able to work with you to lower the amount that you pay them, the amount you pay them back every month.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. A couple emails came in. This is from John in Phoenix, Arizona. His first question is there anything that can be done to prevent production home builders from continuing to exacerbate the problem by continuing to flood the market with unnecessary supply? And two, what happens when these builders are building at cost? In my neighborhood, the same builder that built my home is building it at their cost. Hasn't the market more than corrected them? Robert Schiller?
Well, I think the production home builders have pulled way back. They don't like to sell below cost, and that's the situation that is probably developing in a number of places. So I don't know that we have to do anything about them. Yeah, it's true we have a huge inventory on the market, and it's going to take a while for that to work off. I don't know what he's proposing we do with the production home builders. I think they're in a very distressed state right now.
And this email came in from Julie in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She says, here in Michigan, the economy is particularly bad. Due to layoffs at his company, my husband was forced to find a new job, which he did in Atlanta. So he's been living in Atlanta since June of 2007, where while our two small children and I have remained in Michigan, trying unsuccessfully to sell our house. We're upside down in our mortgage. The cost of maintaining two residences has nearly decimated us financially. All we can do is wait and pray that housing values will improve. Is that the correct tack to take, Dean Proust, or should they just let it go to foreclosure at that point?
That's a tough call, and I'm not gonna proffer advice on someone else's financial situation. That's for a financial planner or some kind of legal aid credit counselor, attorney. But that is one of the bigger questions or one of the bigger issues that we're dealing with, and even in the case of whether these banks are going to be able to find enough homeowners. Are able to help enough to try to break this drop in free fall in housing prices because there are going to be a lot of homeowners out there who, like the caller from Florida, may be looking at a home that's worth $100,000 less than what they paid or is on their mortgage. And the government comes along and says, we got this new program and maybe we can cut your mortgage payment by $100 a month, $200, $250. They may say, I'm down $100,000. I'm down $200,000. I'm moving out and mailing the keys back to the bank. And that is one of the big issues.
Dean Faust is the Atlanta Bureau Chief for Business Week. There is a link to his op-ed on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Thanks very much for joining us. And to you too, Robert Schiller. He's a professor of economics and finance at Yale. His most recent book is titled The Subprime Solution: how today's global financial crisis happened and what to do about it. Thanks very much, gentlemen.
And thank you.
And my pleasure.
We're glad all our callers called us, and we wish them all the best of luck. Up next...
My name's Bond. James Bond.
Roger Moore joins us, 800-989-8255, or email talk@npr.org. I'm Andrea Seabrook. Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Now, fast cars, beautiful women, and a vodka martini shaken, not stirred. In 7 James Bond movies, Roger Moore played the dashing, tuxedoed British agent 007 who saves the world, gets the girl, and looks fabulous doing it. In his new memoir, Roger Moore writes about his life, from a young boy growing up in London during World War II to how he landed the title role of Simon Templar in The Saint, a role that paved the way for his being cast as James Bond when Sean Connery retired. Roger Moore joins us now. If you want to talk with him about his life or his acting career as The Saint, as Bond, that's James Bond, give us a call. 800-989-8255. The email is talk@npr.org. Roger Moore is at our New York Bureau. Welcome, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Andrea.
We're going to hear a lot of stories this hour about your days as James Bond, but I'd like to go back a little bit to ask you about the role of Simon Templar in the TV show The Saint. When you accepted that part, you thought it would only be one season, maybe two. You had no idea how successful it would become.
I even thought it was only going to be a half-hour series, and the contract actually was drawn up, what I thought, for 39 half hours, and was for 39 hours. And it wasn't until Lou Grade, who was the head of ATV and ITC, was making the press announcement and saying, and we're going to do 39 hours, and I said half hours. And the two producers of the show at that time dragged me to one side and said, it's an hour. And I said, well, I must say I read the script and thought it was awfully long for half an hour. But there we are. The agent who drew up that contract was not my agent for very long.
I see. You write in your book, though, and we should say the title of the book is My Word is My Bond, a memoir. You write in your book that those were very happy days for you on The Saint.
Actually, all my days working have been very happy. I just like working. I love the atmosphere of being in a studio or in the theatre. I like being with other actors, and I like being with technicians.
And you write that after Sean Connery left the Bond series, you were on the short list, but the part went to George Lazenby?
They'd actually asked after about the fourth, or the fifth, when Sean was getting anxious to make a move, and I'd been approached, and there was a script being prepared, and locations had been searched out in Cambodia, and then all hell broke loose in Cambodia, and the film was shelved. And by that time, I'd moved on to other things. So George Lazenby came in, did one, and Sean came back, and then Harry Saltzman and Cubby Broccoli approached me.
Let's listen to this scene from The Spy Who Loved Me. You've just met beautiful Russian agent Triple X, played by Barbara Bach.
The lady will have a Bacardi on the rocks.
For the gentleman, vodka martini, shaken, not stirred.
Touché.
Commander James Bond, recruited to the British Secret Service from the Royal Navy. Licensed to kill, and has done so on numerous occasions. Many lady friends, but married only once. Wife killed.
All right, you've made your point.
You're sensitive, Mr. Bond.
About certain things, yes.
Sir Roger Moore, you say that is your favorite Bond movie of the 7 you made. Why is that your favorite?
Well, the director, Lewis Gilbert, was the first film I'd made with him, and he was such a funny man. Identical sense of humor to mine, completely off the wall, mad as a hatter. We just had so many laughs making the film. We also had wonderful occasions. We spent the first month shooting rehearsing in Sardinia. I was learning to ride a wet bike, a jet bike that had never been seen on the screen before. And I managed to get paid just to sit in the sun and eat pasta and drink Italian wine. It's not bad.
Not a bad life, it sounds like there. The first film you made, though, of the Bond series was Live and Let Die, an apt title. You had a serious accident during the shooting that sent you to the hospital. What happened?
You always have accidents on Bond films. So, we were rehearsing practicing driving a jet boat. Now, a jet boat, you know, it does 40, 50 miles an hour, 55 or something, and its steering is completely controlled by the power. So if you put the over to the left, the power, you'll make a left sharp left turn. And the more power you put on, the shorter and quicker the turn. The trouble is, once the power goes, the boat will remain going in the direction you were going when the engine cut out, which is what happened. And somebody had inconveniently left a boathouse on the edge of the bayou that I was supposed to be negotiating, and I went straight into it.
Oh, my goodness.
It was actually lucky that it happened during that sequence, because for the first 10 days, I was hobbling around on a stick. But as we were shooting in a boat, I would just hobbled into the boat and sat down.
This question about Live and Let Die from Clayton in Palo Alto, California. Go ahead.
Hi. I was just wondering, like, what was your favorite part of shooting Live and Let Die? Because there's a lot of really cool boat chases.
Well, thank you, Clayton. The boat chases were great fun to do, apart from the time that I smashed my teeth and my knee. But I had a lot of laughs, and particularly I had some very good friends in it. David Hedison, who played Felix Leiter, and Clifton James, who... there were some great characters around in that film.
That's great. And I understand that you, in the love scenes, of course, there were many of them, the love scenes with Jane Seymour, who played Solitaire in the movie, you both had your socks on back there?
Well, when you've been filming in Jamaica in sort of 120 degrees of no shade, and you come back to a cold English stage in the middle of the winter, and the doors have been open on the stage, and then you have to climb into cold bed, no electric blankets, no hot water bottle, just the two of you freezing to death underneath a sheet, trying to look cool. You needed something on your feet to keep them warm.
Somehow I don't understand the glamour of James Bond with his socks on in bed. But let's go to David in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, David.
Hi, Mr. Moore. Sam Moore, this is a really, really pleasure to talk to you.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
I'm saying it's a pleasure talking to you, sir.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Nice to talk to you.
I grew up in Kenya, in Africa, and I've been a lover of the James Bond movies. But I particularly remember when I was 12 years old, I remember going to the store. My mother had sent me to the store. But I saw that the Bond movie, For Your Eyes Only, was showing that day. And I decided, instead of buying whatever my mother had sent me, I would walk in and just watch the movie. And when I went back home, I had to explain where the money went to. And I had probably the worst whooping my father ever gave me for all my life. But to this day, I still don't regret it. You know, it's one of the...
Well, I'm very sorry you got a whopping for that. I was in Kenya about 3 months ago, in Nairobi and then the Masai Mara. But in Nairobi, I was visiting some UNICEF projects and also a wonderful place for home for abandoned babies run by the Feed the Children organization in America. I found that part of the trip very, very interesting. The rest, Masai Mara, you know, fascinating with the hippos and the lion and the tiger and the ostriches. Yeah, I had a good time.
Roger Moore, it's so much fun to hear that people all over the world know your work. I wonder what it's like to have had a career with a breadth. You did lots of things, but to be defined by these 7 movies you made. I mean, you are James Bond everywhere you go.
Well, I'm James Bond, except for the people that haven't seen a Bond film before, and the first film they see is with Daniel Craig, and he is going to be the definitive Bond. there are many, many, many people just a little older than I am who there can't be many of those around, I tell you.
But
for them, Sean Connery was the definitive Bond. And then there's a whole generation that grew up with Timothy Dalton and with Pierce Brosnan. So it's to be known for something as successful as that after so many years is very gratifying. I'm very happy about it.
Let's take a quick question from Scott in Cazenovia, New York. Scott?
That's right, Cazenovia, New York. Sir Roger, it's just a pleasure to talk with you, and allow me to say that for 35 years, since the very early 70s, my family, my parents, my brother and I, take us very early age to go see the James Bond movies, and we've gone to see every James Bond movie in the theaters. It's always a family event, and I have to say that you and Sean Connery have defined what it is for who James Bond is, and I will always compare all the future James Bonds to Sir Roger Moore and Sean Connery, and we're going to go see, in carrying the tradition this Friday, we're going to see the new one that's out, and I can't wait to tell my mom, my dad, and my brother and new family that I got to say that to Sir Roger Moore today. So thank you. You've done a wonderful job portraying James Bond and helped define who he is in our minds.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you. That's very kind of you. Somebody yesterday in a radio interview said they compared going to a Bond to be a father and son bonding, and that a boy really came of age when his father said to him, "Come on, son, I'll take you to see a Bond movie." It never occurred to me before, but it sounds like a very good selling point for my book.
Curtis?
You know, bond with Bond, and buy your son or buy your dad Bond's book.
My guest is Sir Roger Moore. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go to Curtis in Oklahoma City. You have a family tradition as well?
Yes, we do. As a matter of fact, Sir Roger, the first one of yours that I remember fully seeing all the way through as a kid was your first one, Live and Let Die, and I've always been a big fan of that one.
Thank you.
I had a question. I don't know if this story is true or apocryphal, but I remember reading years ago that your son was asking you if you were tougher than James Bond, and when you said, "Well, I am James Bond," he goes, "No, the real James Bond, Sean Connery."
Yep, that's true. It
was that's gotta hurt.
My son was 8 years old. I took him to lunch at the White Elephant in London, and he sat there. He looked around the room, and he said, "Dad, could you beat up anybody in here?" And I looked around. They're all fairly old. I said, "Yeah, sure, I could." He said, "What about if James Bond came in?" I said, "But I'm going to be James Bond." He said, "No, I mean the real one, Sean Connery." Now, that son of mine has never grown beyond 3'6". I don't know why. No, he's a nice boy.
I see. How about this call from Ted in Boise, Idaho? Ted, go ahead.
Hi, Sir Roger. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
I had a question. I wanted to know if you and Sean Connery and George Lazenby and all the other men who played James Bond ever got together to discuss James Bond and who he was and, yeah, you know, that sort of thing.
It's a small club, but a good one, huh? You guys get together?
No, I see Sean from time to time when he's in London. He lives in the Bahamas. I speak to George Lazenby. In fact, I saw him a few months ago. He's a hell of a nice guy. And Timothy Dalton I see when I'm in California. Pierce I haven't seen for a while. And Daniel Craig I actually met for the first time a month ago. We were at the London Palladium celebrating the 100th anniversary of the birth of Ian Fleming. And that was the first time I met Daniel Craig, and we were sharing a dressing room. And he's one hell of a nice guy.
What do you think of his movies?
I saw Casino Royale. Mm-hmm. I had to buy the DVD. They didn't give me a discount. But I'm only joking. I thought he was absolutely terrific, and I would have been dead after the first 5 minutes of shooting a film with that magnitude of the gymnastics that he went through. He's jumping, he's running. I thought he was terrific.
I've read, and we've gotten some emails from listeners. This one from Nathan in Salem, Oregon, that you are disappointed in the turn the Bond series has taken of late, due presumably to Bond's increasingly violent style.
No, this has been sort of a misquote. I was asked by a journalist the other day, was it true that I'd been upset by the violence of such and such a film, which was my last Bond, which was A View to a Kill, and I had got rather lazy and not seen all the dailies, you know, the work we did the day before. And so I missed some of the stuff where there were sort of machine guns and people falling down dead and blood all over the place. And so when I saw the first rough assembly of the film, I was rather shocked that it had taken that turn for violence. But I don't think I'm disturbed by the violence of Casino Royale, or what would probably, from what I've seen of Quantum Solace. No, I think it's with the times, you know, it's born identity time with movies. And this is what people are looking for, the nitty-gritty and realistic approach, and I'm sure it's the right one. And I was just looking now at the Hollywood Reporter and looking at the figures from the first weekend opening outside America, mm-hmm. where I think they've notched up $180 million. So I think people around the world are accepting it and liking it.
Have you seen? You haven't seen Quantum of Solace yet?
No. We'd just gone to Paris when it opened in London. My book was being released in Paris, where it's not called My Word Is My Bond. It has to be called Amicalement Votre, which was the title of the series I did, The Persuaders, with Tony Curtis.
Ah, I see. Another clever name there. Sir Roger Moore, he joined us from our bureau in New York. His memoir is called My Word Is Bond. And let me say, if I may be so bold, you sound just as dashing now as you ever did, sir. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Andrea. Thank you very much.
And before we sign off, today we say goodbye to producer Ashley Grashaw. Her work has graced this program for almost 2 years. We wish her well as she returns home to Los Angeles, where she can wear flip-flops year-round. Her energy and enthusiasm will be missed. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook.